Erev Tov to everyone. Welcome to part 22 of the series The Presence and the Jews, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Tenishmaso Tzur Rabitzur Achayim. Tonight we're discussing Gerald Dar Ford and Jimmy Carter. So these were two individuals who served as president in the 1970s, and for better or worse, both lived in the shadow of Richard Nixon. Ford, because he succeeded Nixon, pardoned him, and could not quite heal the country of its wounds. And Carter, because he ran against Nixon. He won the election as the anti-Nixon. He was a little arrogant. He ostracized Nixon, added to his pain, something that all of Carter's successors did not do. And he conducted his foreign policy in reaction to Nixon's and weakened the U.S. in the process, and we'll discuss that. And because, like Richard Nixon, he wound up a very unpopular president by the time he left office. Each is unique. Gerald Ford is the only man who served as both president and vice president, never having been elected to either office. It's something, if you think about it. He never won a national election, and so he lacked the legitimacy that a national election could provide. Ford played Big Ten college football. He even received offers from the Lions and the Packers after he graduated college. He was a center, leading one of his antagonists, LBJ, to famously comment that Ford spent too much time playing football without a helmet. Now, he was probably the most athletic president, and therefore it's very odd that he gained the reputation for clumsiness, which is actually false, but nonetheless, that became his reputation. He was also very amiable. He was a good politician, not an ideologue. He was a moderate Republican whose career was spent almost entirely in opposition, leading Newt Gingrich decades later to impugn this bunch of Republicans as what he called the tax collectors for the welfare state. You know, you go along, you get along, you stay your position for decades, and you move on. That was Ford. Jimmy Carter was a real outsider. One-term governor of Georgia who ran against Washington, something that is so common today. Everyone does it, even, I mean, Bernie Sanders been in Congress for 25 years, and he's running against Washington. He ran against Watergate and, of course, against Ford also. Carter, interestingly enough, was the first president who was born in a hospital. And he's among the handful of presidents who lost a re-election bid and served only one term. In this century, it's Taft, Hoover, Carter, and George Bush the First. Carter was also the first president in the 20th century to be open, even aggressive, about his religion, as we recall. He was a Southern Baptist, who taught Bible on Sundays. He was very preachy. He criticized the singles on his staff for immorality, if they were living in sin. It was a quaint concept in the 60s and 70s. And he projected the image of the common man, which of course is completely false. Carter was a huge phony who made a show of carrying a suit bag in public that we now know was always completely empty. It was just a show. He drank in private, but never in public, pretended he was a teetotaler. There was no Toho Kabaro about Carter at all. His public persona, the big smile, the preachy moralizer, was completely at odds with who he was in private. And as we know, Ronald Kessler has made a career writing books, quoting, and often by name, Secret Service agents who worked in the White House. And they said Carter only smiled when the camera was on. No camera, he was actually quite bitter and nasty. So it shouldn't have been a big surprise when he was outed in the 1990s as a Jew hater and an ally of some of the most vicious Jew haters in the world. Typically, Gerald Ford was portrayed by the media as a dunce and Jimmy Carter as a genius because he was a nuclear engineer for a time. Of course, neither stereotype is true. One thing is true, I have to say, both Ford and Carter were much more normal individuals psychologically than their two predecessors, Nixon and Johnson. We'll start with Ford. Ford, the 38th president, was the first president to serve under a different name than his birth name. He was born July 14, 1913, Omaha, Nebraska, and named Leslie Lynch King Jr. after his father, who was extremely abusive. His parents separated 2 weeks after he was born, after Leslie, the father, attacked Ford's mother with a knife and threatened to kill her. So they divorced in December of that year. And 2 years later, she moved to Grand Rapids to be with family. 2 years later, she married Gerald R. Ford. And even though the son was never formally adopted, he took his stepfather's name, kept the junior, Gerald R. Ford Jr. After college at Michigan, Ford coached football at Yale, and he wound up graduating from the law school. He enlisted in the Navy, saw combat in the South Pacific during World War II, almost met his demise. During the war in the South Pacific, a typhoon almost swept him overboard to his demise, December 1944. 800 men drowned. Ford just fell to the deck below, and he was saved as he returned home after the war. Age 35, he married Betty, October 15th, 1948. What did he do the day of his wedding? We campaigned. It was October. He was running for the Congress. So right in the middle of his first campaign, he got married. Campaigned during the day, got married at night. The Fords had four children. Not the first night, of course. And as is well known, Betty became, unfortunately, a hardcore alcoholic, with the Secret Service occasionally having to carry her off Air Force One. And after her daughter led an intervention in the 1970s, she got help. She got sober. She's always quite outspoken, but she founded the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Springs, where they went to live, and she was very active in that. It became a wonderful facility. In any event, Ford swept to victory in 1948 to Congress, and he was elected a dozen times thereafter from his district with never less than 60% of the vote. He was a very able legislator, very likable guy, friends on both sides of the aisle, career politician. That induced Nixon to consider him twice for vice president, both in 1960 and 1968. But it also enabled Ford to be elected a leader in the House, finally becoming minority leader in 1964. Ford even served on the Warren Commission. He didn't hesitate to oppose LBJ on anything, incur his wrath, even his insults, as I noted, on both domestic and foreign policy. Ford even opposed Johnson on Vietnam openly. He felt he was not fighting the war to win, which should be the goal. And when Nixon's problems developed, Ford was supportive of Nixon, and once Vice President Agnew resigned because of his tax evasion plea, Ford was a natural choice, someone who would win overwhelming support in Congress and maybe keep the congressional wolves at bay for Nixon. He was approved by the House and Senate overwhelmingly, sworn in December 6th, 1973. He only served as vice president for 8 months. As Nixon's end neared, Ford met with the chief of staff, Alexander Haig, to discuss future options, including a pardon for Nixon, but no deal was made. And as Congress prepared to begin impeachment hearings, Nixon resigned effective August 9th, 1974. Ford was sworn in. He struck the right note. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not men. Here, the people rule. And he downplayed expectations with a line he'd used before. I'm a Ford, not a Lincoln, which both means the president and the car, I guess. And the nation breathed a sigh of relief. That relief lasted all of 1 month. On September 9th, Ford announced a full and complete pardon to Richard Nixon for any crimes he might have committed as president. And it came after intense negotiations with the Nixon team for weeks, including the explicit recognition by Nixon that a pardon implied that he had committed crimes, which Nixon up to that point had denied. Ford felt that a trial of Nixon was primarily bad for the country, which had to move on. So Ford was lambasted for the decision. He was attacked for the corrupt bargain he struck. Remember the term? It was first used by Andrew Jackson against John Quincy Adams. as if there was some prior agreement to pardon Nixon in exchange for Nixon's resignation. If you think, it makes no sense, because had he been impeached, Ford would be the president anyway. There were discussions, but they never reached any agreement. Ford, in fact, he gave Nixon a deadline. They only negotiated for a week or two with his staff, and he said, this is by this time to decide whether to accept the pardon or not, which means an acceptance of guilt. Ford paid a heavy price for the pardon, an immediate drop in popularity. Top aides resigned. Nixon's enemies and Ford's friends were aghast, and Ford never really recovered from that. You know, to soften the blow, a week later, he announced an amnesty for all draft dodgers, but that also bothered many of his supporters and didn't really please the draft-dodging crowd or their acolytes. In fact, it would be Jimmy Carter who would pardon all the draft dodgers. In retrospect, I think most people agree that Ford was right in pardoning Nixon. In 2001, Caroline Kennedy even awarded Gerald Ford the Profiles in Courage Award, named after a father, of course, for the deed, recognizing that Ford had put his own personal and political interests aside to do what was best for the country. And what was best for the country was not to have a former president sitting in the dock on trial. Those things only happen in Israel. Alongside with the entire American political system, because obviously the corruption extended far beyond Nixon's own doing. It was courageous. The Ford Museum in Grand Rapids, I visited a few years ago, makes the most of it, and correctly so. And only from the perspective of history, decades later, would it be perceived as the right thing to do under the circumstances. But at the time, it contributed to the devastation of the Republican Party in the 1974 midterm elections. Now, Ford was always known as a pro-Israel congressman, reliably voting to increase aid to Israel every time the matter came up. He also spoke up for Soviet Jewry, signing a congressional declaration in 1970 condemning the suppression of Jews in the Soviet Union and calling for the death penalty in the Leningrad 16 case to be commuted. And when it was, Ford said quite eloquently and tellingly that it's a small victory. And we should never forget, I quote, the fact that the Soviet Union is holding Jews in that country against their will is unconscionable. He even spoke at a solidarity rally at Madison Square Garden held on December 13, 1971. And as president, he reiterated his concern and he said he would raise the issue with Brezhnev. The problem was, denouncing the Soviet Union as a congressman from the minority party is actually easy. It carries no obligation and no risk. Doing it as president is not as simple. And here, as in his dealings with Israel, Ford was encumbered by his Secretary of State, the Nixon holdover, Henry Kissinger. Indeed, Kissinger took on an enhanced role because he was serving at this time as both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, because both Kissinger and Ford felt that Ford was not as astute as Kissinger in foreign affairs, and he admitted that. And they also recognized that Ford wasn't as astute as Nixon was. So this association would lead the naturally amiable Ford into sharp conflict with Jews and with Israel. And this notwithstanding that in December 1974, Ford invited 20 Jewish leaders to the White House, and most were very impressed with what he had to say, especially since he emphasized that the U.S. disagreed with NATO, did not support a full Israeli withdrawal from the lands captured in 1967. So what happened? What went wrong? In both spheres, Ford ran into problems because of his reliance on Kissinger, because of the diminution of the powers of the presidency imposed by Congress in the wake of Watergate, and because his assertiveness changed his relationship with Congress. It rubbed them the wrong way. I mean, he was just good old Jerry for 25 years. Now he's the president, so they had good relations with him, and now they just considered him an accidental president who should not wield all the powers that previous presidents had. And then the whole Nixon era came under scrutiny. And Kissinger lost some of his luster as well. It was revealed that Nixon and Kissinger had tried to overthrow Salvador Allende, the Marxist leader of Chile, and other escapades as well. So Kissinger came under withering attack. Congress didn't want to hear from him anymore. So after successfully pushing off the Jackson-Vanik Amendment for 2 years, that would link American trade with any nation to its human rights record, matters came to a head in 1974 with a new SALT treaty in the works and quiet diplomacy working as well as they wanted it to work in terms of Jewish emigration. Kissinger and Ford did not want any limitations on trade with the Soviets and certainly no linkage with human rights. This became a bitter struggle with Congress. Ford convinced the Soviet foreign minister Anatoly Dobrynin to increase the number of Jews freed annually to 55,000 in exchange for abandoning the trade bill. And Dobrynin agreed, as long as the number would not be put in writing. But Congress rebuffed Ford and Kissinger, passed Jackson-Vanik overwhelmingly 88-0 in the Senate. So Ford was forced to sign it, but was bitter about it. Congress had reinforced the principle of free immigration, but at a price. The Soviets cut real immigration drastically. So from the promised 55,000, actual Jewish immigration was limited to 13,000, and they stepped up their suppression of Jews as well. Meanwhile, Kissinger was plodding away with his shuttle diplomacy between Israel and Egypt and Syria in the wake of the Yom Kippur War, Ford having completely left that field to Kissinger. Kissinger looked for comprehensive agreements done gradually at a particular end in mind, but Israel was unwilling to barter its assets for words. That would eventually happen and become Israel's policy through Oslo. But now, though, the Rabin government kept rejecting every Kissinger proposal, including a withdrawal that was demanded behind the Mitlan Gidi passes in the Sinai, and the return of the Abu Rodes oil fields in Egypt, in Sinai, to Egypt, that Israel had developed, in exchange for nothing, not even a non-belligerency pact. To Kissinger, Sadat was always flexible, the Israelis were always intransigent, and so Kissinger left in anger in February 1975. Within a month, he talked Gerald Ford into the worst crisis in American-Israel relations from the Sinai campaign until the Iraq deal of 2015. In March 1975, Ford sent a letter to Rabin stating that Kissinger was suspending his mission because of Israel, and Ford expressed his, I quote, profound disappointment over Israel's attitude in the course of the negotiations. I've given instructions for reassessment of U.S. policy in the region, including our relations with Israel. So this threat was across the board, included stoppage of aid, stoppage of weapons shipments, planes and missiles, and a loss of diplomatic support in international forums. Israel was shocked, and in the short term became even more stubborn, with Begin in opposition supporting Rabin. Rabin and Kissinger got into a shouting match, he came back anyway, with Rabin saying to him at one point, "You will be judged not by American history, but by Jewish history." Kissinger, months later, arrived in Israel, went to the King David Hotel, where he always stayed, and was greeted by a mob shouting, "Jew boy, go home." And it's not as if at this time the U.S. had been Israel's main weapon source and support for that long, maybe 7 years. But after the Yom Kippur War, dozens of countries had broken off diplomatic relations with Israel, most of Africa and Asia, and the U.S. had become basically Israel's only ally in the world. In the end, both sides backed down. AIPAC mobilized. In May 1975, 76 senators sent a letter to Ford, angering and horrifying him, urging him to be responsive to Israel's request for $2.5 billion in aid and to support Israel's insistence on defensible borders. So Ford was outraged. Kissinger soon gave up his shuttle diplomacy, but not before fine-tuning what became the second disengagement agreement in 1975. In fact, Israel did part with the oil fields of Abu Rodeis and the Mitlan-Gidi passes. Begin now criticized Rabin for caving in and getting nothing in return. Behind the scenes, Ford committed not to recognize the PLO until the PLO recognized Israel and to guarantee Israel's oil needs should the supply ever be jeopardized. But those are the types of agreements that are easily forgotten, and in fact, to a good extent, they were. All this whole process left a sour taste in Gerald Ford's mouth. He said of the Israelis, they are not the easiest people to deal with. Who believes that? Gerald Ford did name the first Jewish Attorney General, Edward Levy, and Alan Greenspan, again the economist, not the dermatologist, became the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and Jews rejoiced in the appointment of Pat Moynihan as UN ambassador, in which position he, along with Ford, vehemently opposed the UN Zionism is Racism resolution in November 1975. Ford also addressed the Chabad dinner in May 1975, first time a president did that. He pronounced Lubavitch and Shalom correctly, but he stumbled on Mazel Tov and Tsaris. All right, Mazel Tov became Mazal Tov, and Tsaris became Tsaras, which sounds like leprosy. And he concluded his speech with Washington's blessing to the Jews of Newport. He also exchanged letters with the Lubavitcher Rebbe on the 25th anniversary of the Rebbe's ascension. None of this helped Ford in 1976. The economy was suffering, stagflation. The U.S. was humiliated having to flee Vietnam. Congress just refused to authorize money to continue to fight. And the U.S. lost its first war on Ford's watch. An American ship, the Mayaguez, was seized by Cambodians, and a rescue attempt failed miserably, so the mood in the country was dark, and a newcomer to the national scene with a toothy smile, promises of integrity and honesty, won the Democrat nomination, one James Earl Carter Jr. Now, Jimmy Carter was so unknown in the United States, in 1974, he appeared on What's My Line? And no one could guess who he was or what he did. He was the governor of Georgia at the time. 2 years later, he became the 39th president, defeating a field of better-known candidates, including Scoop Jackson, Frank Church, Mo Udall, and Jerry Brown, still around. So how did Carter do it? Well, Carter was born October 1st, 1924, in Plains, Georgia, into a family that had come to America in the 1600s. So they were mainly farmers. His father was also, but Carter gained admission to the Naval Academy and then served in the Navy for 6 years. In the Navy, or after his service, he began studying nuclear engineering, and he became very close with then-Captain Chaim Gedalia Rickover. Born in Poland, as a child, came to America, took the name Hyman. Jimmy Carter became his prized disciple and primary influence when Captain Rickover then asked him if he had done his best at the academy because he applied to enter his program. Carter thought and answered no. And Rickover said to him, why not? And that became Carter's autobiography from the 70s, Why Not the Best? Admiral Rickover, despite the name Chaim Gedalia, intermarried, unfortunately, and his children were lost to the Jewish people. Jimmy Carter married Rosalind in 1946, and she, over time, and really to this day, has ameliorated some of the rougher aspects of his personality. Occasionally, can be just as sanctimonious. They also have four children. Of all the presidents, this Kessler writes in the book, the Secret Service despised Jimmy Carter the most. They like Roslin. They despised him, not only as a phony, but as a nasty, condescending phony who would tell them and even his military escorts not to greet him in the morning, as he did not want to have to answer them. And sadly, his daughter Amy was a special piece of work, they report. at the time they came to the White House, about 10 years old, she would crumple cookies on Air Force One on the carpet just so the stewards would have to come and clean up after her, because that was their job. Do it like, you know, one after the other. Carter developed, she, by the way, you know, was quite a character. She went to Brown but was expelled for poor grades. She became a big activist, big far-left activist. She was arrested, in fact, in the 90s when, or the late 80s, when she protested having the military recruit on the campus of Brown University. When she got married in her 30s, she refused to have her father give her away, I guess a Christian custom, because she said, I don't belong to anyone. And she's basically disappeared. She lives a quiet lifestyle today. Jimmy Carter developed a successful peanut business. He was elected a Georgia state legislator and then elected governor. Served one term, 1971, 1975. And age 51, began his campaign for president. He defeated his Democrat opponents by running really one of the first, he had a couple in the 19th century, but in our context, one of the first outsider campaigns. First, not the last, campaigning against Washington, corruption, the establishment. Now everybody runs against the establishment. Even the establishment runs against the establishment today. And he won the nomination going away, promising, I will never lie to you, and a clean break with Watergate. Meanwhile, Gerald Ford narrowly fended off a challenge from an ascendant Ronald Reagan. Ford won 26 primaries in 1976. Reagan won 24. And the delegate count was so close, it was not apparent that Ford would win until they actually voted on the first ballot. It's interesting. Some of the youthful, then young activists who were on the floor of the 1976 campaign on the Reagan and Ford sides are still active now, 40 years later, in the campaigns going on today. Well, Ford started a presidential campaign. See, he won on the first ballot by a very small number of votes. Ford began the presidential campaign far behind Jimmy Carter in the polls, but he slowly crept up. Carter stumbled when he said in an interview that he had always lusted in my heart after other women, which actually, understand the perspective he's coming from. He said he committed adultery many times in his heart, which is a lot better than many other candidates in recent times who've run for president. It was a strange thing to admit back then. Now it seems almost moral. But Ford stumbled even more when in a debate he declared, I quote, there's no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe and never would be under a Ford administration, which was news to all of Eastern Europe. And I clarify what he meant, but by then it was too late. Ford said about Jimmy Carter during the election, he was a modified Teddy Roosevelt, speak softly and carry a fly swatter. Well, the guy with the fly swatter edged Ford by 50.1 to 48%, 1.8 million votes out of 80 million cast. Very narrow electoral victory, 297 to 240. Most analysts say the election were 2 weeks later, Ford would have won because he was surging at the end. If he hadn't been a Southerner, this became a Democratic formula really since then. He had two Southerners and one black. If he hadn't been a Southerner, Carter would have lost badly. It was the Deep South that carried him to victory. Ronald Reagan would realign American politics, and no Democrat has carried the Deep South since, not even Bill Clinton. He just won a handful of states. Now, Carter had to deal with a terrible economy that he made worse, even with the first strides to deregulation, which took place under his term, airline deregulation, for example. Inflation was high, interest rates were high. What Carter called, when he ran the misery index, which was 12%, by the end of his term was over 20% combined. There was a lingering energy crisis. Carter famously appeared on television in a cardigan sweater, urging people to lower their thermostats. Another time he decried the crisis of confidence in American life, what became known as the malaise speech, when he mentioned the word, but he took no responsibility for causing that malaise. He was just much too preachy, and he had no ideas, all right? Reminds me that when Obama spoke yesterday at Rutgers, One of the things he said is that candidates promise you a return to the good old days. But in America, there never were any good old days. It's all mythology. All right? Well, that Carter came from the same mentality as well. It's not his fault. It's just the way it is. Such presidents often turn their attention to foreign policy, which in fact Jimmy Carter did. Now, Carter, the Jews were very nervous about Jimmy Carter before he was elected. Carter was a Southern Baptist. That denomination is strongly supportive of missionary work, of proselytizing Jews. It was during Carter's administration, one of their leading preachers infamously said, it was 1980, that God does not hear the prayer of a Jew. I guess that would exclude Jesus as well, but who's counting? Carter distanced himself from the missionary rhetoric, and he accused Ford during their debate of, I quote, bringing Israel to its knees with the reassessment, something he said he would never do. Which he in fact did in the end, but American Jews being Democrats supported Carter over Ford 71-27%. Now, no president ever appointed more Jews to his cabinet than did Jimmy Carter. He had Michael Blumenthal, the Secretary of the Treasury. Of course, a bad economy, let people blame the Jews. Blumenthal was Berlin-born, and after Kristallnacht, his family escaped to Shanghai, where he spent the war years. The Jewish Museum in Shanghai features Michael Blumenthal's visit back to Shanghai while he was Treasury Secretary, and his account of life there. Blumenthal also intermarried. Harold Brown, Secretary of Defense, Phil Klutznik, Secretary of Commerce, Neil Goldschmidt became, then he was the youthful mayor of Portland, Oregon, became the Secretary of Transportation in 1979. Prominent among his advisors was Stuart Eisenstadt, whom Carter had known from Georgia as a conservative Jew, a Shomer Shabbos, who was careful to leave early Friday to work on Shabbos, serious person. Max Kampelman, on the flip side, his foreign affairs advisor, national security advisor, was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who seemed to lack any affection for the Jewish people. And his secretary, say, for the most part, was Cyrus Vance, afflicted with the American disease that any problem can be solved if you just get the right words down on paper, regardless of what happens afterwards. Well, all this brings us to Carter, Israel, and the Camp David Accords. But first, March 1977, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister, met Jimmy Carter and was frankly horrified. They got off on the wrong foot. Carter had a practice which might be construed as cloying, of bringing world leaders to his 10-year-old daughter's bedroom at night to look in on her while she's sleeping, I guess in the hopes of softening them up, bring out the human side. Robin apparently was the only world leader who, when asked, you want to see my daughter Amy sleeping, he said, no. He always had a gruff side. But when they negotiated, Robin despaired. He came thinking that the gradual approach of Kissinger would continue, while Carter wanted to resolve every issue in one big international conference in Geneva. Right after Rabin left, 10 days, Carter announced that the U.S. supported what he called a Palestinian homeland in Israel, an ominous first. And it was also on that trip that Leah Rabin was caught withdrawing money from an illegal bank account they maintained in Washington. Rabin soon resigned. Shimon Peres became the Labor candidate. And after a very, very bitter campaign, Menachem Begin won a stunning victory. And it was an electoral revolution in Israel. And just 4 months after Carter became president. On the surface, they had much in common, both Bible believers, both believers in God and destiny, and perhaps it was that similarity that made them such antagonists, even if Begin always maintained the front of good relations. And something else as well, obviously there's a divide between Jewish theology and Christian theology. Our world views are different, and for the first time, that played itself out on the international scene. Carter had almost a messianic complex and was determined to bring peace to the Middle East, although along the lines of the trite land for peace formula, as if the dispute between Israel and its neighbors was all about real estate. Of course, it's not. There was no land for peace issue before 1967, and there still wasn't peace. It's an existential conflict, and still is. But Begin came to office never having accepted the land for peace formula, and indeed the opposite was true. He claimed Yesha, Judea Samaria Gaza, as the biblical heartland of Israel, God-given, never to be returned, and he promised, as the morning after the election, he visited Elon Moreh, he promised to build Jewish settlements throughout the land. There will be many more Elon Morehs, he said. And now Jimmy Carter despaired, and he looked to tighten the screws on Israel. Almost immediately, he blocked Israel from selling the Kfir fighter jet to other countries, and he proposed selling U.S. warplanes and weaponry to Saudi Arabia. And so that's a package deal. Either you both get or no one gets. Eventually, Israel would acquiesce. And less than a decade after America had become Israel's primary weapons supplier, America, Carter's America, became the lead supplier of weapons to Israel's enemies as well. Jews were too taken in by Jimmy Carter, as we learned, for the most part, only after he left office. When Carter met Arafat for the first time later in the 1980s, he said to Arafat, "You should not be concerned that I am biased. I am much more harsh with the Israelis. I have a permanent, unassailable commitment to do what I can for the Palestinians." And so it was. Ford had given Israel a letter promising the U.S. would never impose a settlement on Israel. Carter told Begin he's not bound by that letter. By the way, history repeats itself. Bush gave Prime Minister Sharon a letter, essentially acquiescing to Israeli settlements, would not have to be surrendered. Obama came to office, and Hillary Clinton immediately said to Netanyahu, "We're not bound by that letter." That was Bush's opinion. Same thing. Watch what you agreed to. Begin arrived in Washington July 1977, and the day before he met Jimmy Carter, he visited Rav Soloveitchik. Then he traveled to Crown Heights to meet Lubavitcher Rebbe. He had known Rav Soloveitchik from their youth. Remember, Begin was born in Brisk, and the Rav's grandfather, Chaim, was the Rav of Brisk. He met the Rebbe in Crown Heights. He came there, and the Rebbe urged him to remain firm and not compromise Israel's territorial integrity one inch. The first meeting between Carter and Begin in Washington promised to be frosty, even with temperatures reaching 110 degrees. I remember that quite well. July 1977, you may remember, in New York, temperatures reached 112 degrees. I had the misfortune of having to use the subway down to Manhattan at the time, which often was not air-conditioned. And that was the summer of the blackout also. That's how hot it was. Carter had called Israel, the survival of Israel, a moral imperative. But he had a different conception as to how that survival should be preserved. The atmosphere was extremely tense. So Carter announced that the U.S. was abandoning the Nixon-Kissinger approach of incremental negotiations in favor of comprehensive peace conference in Geneva, resolve all issues, and lead to a genuine peace. So that part was good news to Israel, as even United Nations Resolution 242 referred to a just and lasting peace. But Carter's expectation was Israel would withdraw almost entirely to the 1967 borders, and that some means was necessary to allow the PLO to participate. Begin allowed Shmuel Katz, a South African who was old comrade from the Irgun, to present Israel's case. And Katz argued that Israel is fighting for its survival. One tiny Jewish state amid 22 Arab states sworn to its destruction. And Arabs have no claim to the land of Israel, Shmuel Katz said. Belongs to the Jewish people since ancient times. And there are few indigenous Arabs. That's why so many fled in 1948. They had no connection to the land. Well, Carter was getting angrier by the moment. And then Begin spoke. And he brought out a map with Israel's insecure borders before the Six-Day War, And he said, passionately, Israel would never return to such a situation. And he spoke about the Holocaust, and 6 million Jews murdered, and his parents murdered, and 1.5 million children. And he banged the table, and he yelled, Mr. President, I take an oath before you in the name of the Jewish people, this will never, ever happen again. And Begin's eyes filled with tears. Jimmy Carter was unmoved. Vance and Brzezinski were dismissive. When Begin was asked to hold back on creating settlements that would destroy any chance for peace, he anticipated the question. Begin had trained as a lawyer before the war. He removed a paper from his pocket and read, there are 11 places in the U.S. named Hebron, 6 towns named Bethlehem, 5 named Shiloh, 6 named Bethel. Would the U.S. ever pass a law barring Jews from living in those places? Of course not. Be racist. So how can we tell Jews they can't live in the original places? Original Hebron, Beit Lechem, etc. So Carter responded because that would be an obstacle to peace and preclude a Geneva conference. Well, in the end, Begin agreed to attend the Geneva conference without the PLO, and that everything was negotiable. Now, Begin was always very lawyerly, legalistic to a fault. When he said negotiable, he meant that each side brings its positions and you negotiate. But when the Arabs and Americans heard negotiable, to them it meant, well, you have to compromise your position. Otherwise, you're not negotiating. That night of their meeting, July 1977, Carter hosted a state dinner for Begin at the White House. It's hard to imagine, because prime ministers have been visiting for almost 3 decades, but it was the first kosher dinner ever at the White House under Hashgacha, only because Begin insisted. Before then, all right, we know what was happening before then. What Carter didn't know is that Begin had already opened up 2 back channels to Sadat, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, one through Nicolae Ceaușescu of Romania, and separately through King Hassan II of Morocco, offering the Sinai to Sadat for peace and recognition. Now, neither Sadat nor Begin wanted to go to Geneva, because both, especially the Egyptians, were interested in keeping the Soviets out of the Middle East. Ultimately, that is what led Sadat Yerushalayim, with Carter enjoying the fruits of the maxim, political success is the ability, when the inevitable occurs, to get credit for it. How much Sadat cared about the Palestinians is negotiable, and Begin didn't believe they existed, but Sadat felt he could not gain the support from the Arab world unless some agreement on the Palestinian issue was made, some fig leaf. And of course, even he was surprised, Sadat was, by the intransigence of the entire Arab world that broke off diplomatic relations with Egypt after the peace treaty was signed. What Sadat wanted, besides the Sinai, was to reorient Egyptian foreign policy away from the Soviets and towards an alliance with the Americans, and for him that worked swimmingly well. Sadat visited Israel November 1977. Many Israelis, including the defense minister, Ezer Weitzman, thought it was a trap. The whole Israeli cabinet was there. The government, there were sharpshooters set up in the terminal, trained on the Egyptian, with their rifles trained on the plane that landed, in case instead of Sadat, Egyptian commandos came out and shot the Israeli leadership. In the end, it was Sadat who came out. And even during Sadat's Knesset speech, Weizmann passed a note to Begin that Egypt is preparing for war. And that's why Sadat is here. Well, that didn't happen. What did happen, though, is that despite the euphoria, the talks foundered on the fate of the Arabs of Eretz Yisrael, as Begin called them, and Yerushalayim, and there was an increase in Arab terror. One attack killed Gail Rubin, who was the niece of Abe Ribicoff. And in 1978, there were incursions from Lebanon that necessitated Operation Litani. Begin assumed they'd be able to finesse the issue of Sinai, surrender most of it, but not all of it. The talks dragged on, and things became tense, and Carter inserted himself with a messianic fervor that reflected his personality. Arrogant, omniscient, supremely self-confident, Carter became so preoccupied with Israel that he ignored the rising discontent in Iran with the Shah, even chastising and undermining the Shah of Iran. And Carter would yet welcome the overthrow of the Shah by the Ayatollah Khomeini in early 1979, seeing him as a religious personality who would bring good to his people and to the world. Well, such decisions are what make bad presidents bad presidents. Meanwhile, for the first half of 1978, the Egyptian-Israeli talks made little progress, and it was Carter, even more than Sadat, who pushed and pressured Israel to compromise with a withdrawal from Judea and Samaria, which Begin had ruled out. Carter even recognized the rights of the Palestinian people, again disavowing a pledge made by Gerald Ford. As that was the real sticking point along Yerushalayim, no progress was made. Carter grew angry with Begin, even though Begin offered for the first time autonomy and self-rule to the Arabs of the land of Israel. September 1978, Carter called both sides to an open-ended summit at Camp David that would last until an agreement was reached or one party left. It was unprecedented that a president would spend so much time on one foreign policy issue in which the U.S. had an interest, but not a real dominant interest, and at the same time isolate himself from all other responsibilities. But with the U.S. economy flailing, Carter needed a foreign policy victory. Unfortunately, all compromises were expected to be made by Israel. A Sadat compromise was when he accepted less than he demanded. It was brutal at times. They met several times a day, except on Shabbos, when Begin refused to negotiate, do any business at Shabbos meals. Begin spent part of the time playing chess with Brzezinski. Begin had an aide, Yechiel Kadishai, just died last year, who said of Begin and Brzezinski, they're two poles apart. Get the joke? They're both poles. Begin beat Brzezinski 2 out of 3, apparently, with Brzezinski later claiming he let Begin win to make him more malleable in negotiations. It was a total news blackout, which especially made Israelis nervous. For 13 days, they haggled. Sadat packed his bags to leave a number of times, especially when Begin refused to withdraw Israeli settlements from Sinai, and Begin refused to accept any compromise on Yerushalayim or what Carter called the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. Begin, in fact, passionately again, tears and mentioning Jewish history, said, "Meshkachech Yisham Tishkach Yemini, I am not going to do anything to weaken the Jewish people's sovereignty of Yerushalayim." For all the hoopla over the Camp David Accords, the truth is that not much was agreed on, although the very fact that it took place generated its own momentum. There was much left to be negotiated, which was not fully appreciated by onlookers who saw the smiles and the mutual praise between the three protagonists. I remember the night, it was a Sunday night, I was in law school then, I just started, and watching on television the ceremony at the White House pretty late, and I remember at the end, I watched it again this week, Begin decided to take advantage of a primetime audience and address the people of Israel directly in Hebrew, all right, which probably flummoxed the networks, because they didn't have an interpreter handy. But he said, among other things, Ezrachei Yisrael, he said, "We tried, it was very difficult negotiations, etc. We're going to keep trying. Ad yavo hayom, until the day comes, v'chol echad meitanu yuchol lomar bashalom al ameinu v'al artzeinu. Each of us can say that peace has come upon our people and our land. Lo rak b'dor hazeh, ela gam b'dorot haba'im. Not just in this generation, but future generations as well. Bezrat Hashem, with God's help, yachad nasig et matar hazot, will achieve this objective, v'nizkel imim tovim shel binyan v'achava v'havana, and will merit good days of building, of brotherhood, and of understanding. Kein yehi ratzon." What I noticed is not only did he get into any of the details, but he didn't really say anything had been worked out. And in fact, it wasn't worked out. They just couldn't. Again, despite all the euphoria. On Sinai, Begin's big compromise was to let the Knesset decide whether or not to uproot the settlements in Sinai. Previously, he had vowed to retire to Yamit. 10 days later, the Knesset approved the Camp David Accords, 84-19, with 17 abstentions. Yitzhak Shamir voted against, in fact, in Chayrut, Begin's party. Only 9 of 21 Chavrei Knesset supported Camp David. In the Mafdal, only 5 of 12 right-wing elements of Begin's coalition left the government and haven't yet really returned yet to the Likud. On Judea Samaria, Begin agreed to a 5-year transition plan to autonomy, after which final status would be negotiated. That never happened. Among other reasons, he put Yosef Borg in charge of the negotiations, and Borg could talk anything to death. If you have a session of 5 hours, he would just talk for 4 hours and 58 minutes. That's the way he was. And of course, it also didn't go anywhere because the Arabs rejected the plan. And Begin always insisted, after the 5 years, they could present any claims they want. Israel would present its claim for sovereignty as well, but Begin talked himself, again the lawyer, into accepting the phrase legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, reasoning that if the rights are not defined specifically, it's just an empty phrase. But that turned out to be a mistake. On Yerushalayim, the parties just exchanged letters about their respective positions. The one definite was a negotiation. The negotiation of a full peace treaty between the two countries that ended the state of war. And that treaty has more or less held now for almost 40 years. But nothing is ever certain. And the truth is, Egypt has very uncertain control over the Sinai today. And yet they came out, and they're all smiles and all happy, thanking each other, thanking Carter, etc. Golda Meir said right afterwards, we found out the details, she said, I'm not sure in the end whether Begin and Sadat will get the Nobel, but for certain, both should get the Oscar. It turns out, Begin and Sadat did get the Nobel Peace Prize, and Carter did not, which irritated him for the next 2.5 decades. With all this, the treaty still had to be negotiated and again ran into roadblocks, necessitating a trip by Jimmy Carter to the region, March 1979, in which the treaty was hammered out along these lines, with much still left to be resolved. March 26, 1979, treaty was signed on the White House lawn. Begin was eloquent and moving. No more war, no more bloodshed, no more bereavement. Peace unto you, shalom, salam, forever. And he spoke about the murder of his parents by the Nazis and his siblings. 6 million Jews murdered, and no nation heard their cries, and famously put on a kippah. He read Tehillim Kuf Chaf Vav, B'shuv Hashem Hashivat Zion, Hayinu Kechomim. A few months later, Carter's UN ambassador, Andrew Young, was caught negotiating with the PLO representative to the UN against what was supposed to be American policy, and he was forced to resign. By then, they were very close to the election year. Carter's administration also began to collapse. The economy was bad. Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. There were oil shortages. In November 1979, the Ayatollah's men attacked the American embassy in Tehran, took 52 American hostages, held them until Reagan became president, January 20th, 1981. And of course, remember the failed rescue attempt where Americans were killed and did not succeed in accomplishing the mission. America's standing in the world declined precipitously. At the UN, Carter approved a resolution condemning Israel for building settlements. How things never change. Still have that today. Saying privately he didn't care how many Jewish votes he lost. 1980, Ted Kennedy mounted a challenge to Carter, lost, but Carter was badly wounded by the divisive convention. Reagan swept the Republican nomination, and with a third party candidate, John Anderson, siphoning off votes, mainly from Carter, Reagan won 51% of the vote to Carter's 41%. 44 out of 50 states, 489 to 49 in the Electoral College. It's a real drubbing, except for the Jews. Carter still won the Jewish vote, but note this, by 45-39, 45%, Reagan got 39%, and even there, Jimmy Carter is the only Democrat since 1924 to receive less than 60% of the Jewish vote, and he didn't even get 50%. That's how unpopular he was. When he left office, Carter was very active. He was critical of Reagan, of Bush, especially critical of Israel. In recent years, Carter accused Israel of controlling and colonizing Palestinian land, an indication that his Bible study can't be that deep. And his allegation in a book he wrote that Israel is an apartheid state marks him as just another Jew hater. The fact is, Israeli Arabs are full citizens of Israel. And the Arabs of Judea and Samaria are not Israeli citizens. Why should they be treated the same? Just to summarize, Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter each had their problems with Jews. Both of them, interestingly enough, were two of the longest living presidents. Ford died in 2006 at age 93. Carter will turn 92 in October. No president has lived longer than Ronald Reagan, who died at age 94. And Carter was finally awarded his Nobel Peace Prize in 2002, in part for his opposition to George W. Bush and the war in Afghanistan, but for his other works as well. Neither Ford nor Carter were distinguished for their support for Israel when crunch time came. At the end of his presidency, and for the better part of the last 35 years, Jimmy Carter has been obsessively antagonistic to the Jewish settlement in the heartland of Israel and has colored the thinking of many leftist American Jews. Both men pressured Israel, and Israel mostly resisted the pressure, and in the areas in which Israel conceded, the book of history is still open. The irony is that the same debates over the same issues with the same proposed solutions still crop up today, so many years later, a testament to the lack of vision of the diplomats, the denial of the reality of the hatred of Israel in the Middle East and in much of the world, and really the intractability of the conflict. Ronald Reagan would inherit this conflict and some of its failed ideas, and his reservoir of goodwill towards the Jewish state would change the atmosphere despite all the trials and all the wars of the 1980s. And all that we'll take up next time. I thank you all very much.